It's Wednesday, March the 30th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. With me today are politics editor Pat Leahy and the new leader of the Labour Party, Ivana Bacik. Ivana, congratulations.
Thank you very much, Hugh. I'm absolutely honoured and delighted to have been elected as leader of the party, and somewhat overwhelmed too, as I said last week. But really delighted. A big challenge is ahead, but I'm up for it.
I'm reminded of the Ernest Hemingway quote, which was about bankruptcy. So maybe it's not a good parallel, but that things happen gradually and then all at once. And in a way, that's the political trajectory of your career, isn't it? I heard you on the radio saying that, you know, if the seat hadn't become available that you were elected to in the by-election last summer, you could still have been sitting in the Senate rather than leading the Labour Party in the Dáil.
Well, absolutely. And it's a great quote from Hemingway, actually. When I was elected last summer in the by-election, which was very unexpected, as you said, my favourite headline was "Overnight Success After 30 years, which summed up my political career, I felt, in that way, of that sort of sudden developments, sudden changes, but, you know, years of work as well. So, yeah, that's absolutely true. Certainly it's been a rollercoaster year.
You had stood for the Dáil previously, but in the wrong constituencies, is it fair to say?
Yes, and indeed I hadn't stood in a Dáil election in 10 years. So I suppose I was very different context politically the previous time I had stood in the Dáil. I'd been really grateful to the Trinity voters who elected me four times in succession to serve as Trinity senator, and, you know, loved my time in the Shannon and used it very productively. I was able to bring forward and get past more private members' bills or opposition bills than any other senator. And, you know, really, I think the Shannon has huge strength and brings huge extra value to the legislative process in our scrutiny of legislation, but also in the collaborative and collegiate style and debating methods that we use. You know, and I've seen a lot of ministers over the years in different governments choose to bring forward bills into the Shannon first in order to tease out any issues with them and discuss amendments in that more deliberative way. So I think the Shannon has real strength, and I really did appreciate being able to work as a legislator there for so long.
Having said that, and I've seen election literature floating around because I think the count of the election for your replacement is happening as we speak over the next couple of days, it is still a rotten borough and a stain on our democratic processes that Trinity graduates get to elect three seats.
Well, first of all, I'm really hoping that Ursula Quill will win the Trinity Shannon by-election caused by my election last summer to the Dáil. She's a fantastic candidate and would make a really strong addition to the Shannon chamber. Yes, absolutely. The Shannon processes overall are due for reform, not just the Trinity seats, but indeed the entire method of election. And in fact, there's been so many reports for change. We all had really thought and hoped that the Maurice Manning review would be the last one. And we, Labour senators, and in fact, I authored it, we were the only sitting group of senators to put forward a submission to that review, seeking a reform and putting forward, again, practical proposals for reforms that you could make to make the Shannon a much more democratic chamber without the need for further constitutional referendum. Because the referendum on abolition, of course, was defeated on the basis that people wanted to see a change as brought in. And there did seem at that point, and certainly over recent years, there seemed to have been more of a political momentum behind reform, which I would very much support. I mean, I would like to, and I always said I would like to have seen at least as a first step, the six university seats open to graduates of all third level institutions. So to break that NUI Trinity division that's currently there and to have it open to all graduates. But equally, I would also like to see the election method to the other panels reformed. And as I say, we really developed strong proposals for reform that I'm still hopeful government may bring forward. Doesn't seem to be a priority for this government, I have to say, but it did in the last government. It was at least indicated they would do it.
Pat, what do you make of Ivana's 30-year meteoric rise to prominence and what it tells
you,
us about about the Labour Party?
Well, I suppose there's a bit to unpack there, Hugh. I suppose the first thing one would say, you know, is that there's two ways of approaching that question. One is about Ivana herself, and I think so much has been written and windbagged about her at this stage. There's very little including the Irish Times, very little that I can add to that. But I suppose the other way of looking at it is, you know, what it says about the Labour Party, where the Labour Party is, the future of the Labour Party, and what role, if any, it's going to play in our politics and government over the foreseeable future, during which time that Ivana is the leader of the party. I mean, I did the tot when writing on her leadership before, so I'm not sure if she's the eighth or the ninth or the tenth leader in the last 20 years, but certainly there's been quite a high turnover of leaders in the last two decades, and that with it seems an increasing velocity of the party's propensity to change leaders. I mean, Alan Kelly was only leader for 2 years, which and that during a pandemic, and he didn't get to fight a general election as leader, which is unusual for any party that it wouldn't, that a leader wouldn't get that opportunity. That having been said, it was clearly the unanimous view of his parliamentary party that he should no longer lead the party. And whilst that may have been, even by the standards of politics, pretty brutal, it was clearly more or less unanimous in the party and therefore inevitable. You know, I think that the party is in a very difficult position. All political parties are coalitions, but the Labour coalition has been perhaps an unusually disparate one, bridging a gap between, you know, urban Liberals, and a lot of its more reliable seats tended to be in, you know, the urban areas of rural constituencies, places like Clonmel, where I come from, Tralee, Mullingar, Waterford, you know, places in rural Ireland, but in the urban parts of those constituencies. And I think that coalition is kind of broken. Ivana, I think she wouldn't mind me admitting, more represents more the urban liberal part of that tradition. It seems to have lost a lot of the other part of that coalition, and there's a lot more competition for the first part of that coalition. Its urban working class vote has been, which it was always in an unequal competition for Fianna Fáil for, it's now in an even more unequal competition with Sinn Féin for. Its urban middle class intellectual vote, if you like, faces challenges from all over the place, including the Social Democrats. So I think there is a number of profoundly difficult questions whose answers will have far-reaching implications, I think, for Ivana's leadership and for the party as a whole. And while her record as a legislator in the Shannon is certainly impressive, legislating and indeed parliamentary performance as a whole is only very, it's only a part of and perhaps a small part of the responsibilities of a party leader. The other parts of that job are, I suppose, you know, invigorating the party organisation, connecting with the grassroots, communicating and establishing a rapport with the public at large, making decisions about electoral strategy, candidate strategy, driving through her will into the wider party organisation like that, ensuring that she picks the right candidates and then ensuring that the local organisations unite behind them, deciding electoral strategy and ultimately deciding what the party's strategy for entering or not entering government and with whom. So you know, I think she's got a pretty big job ahead of her. And unlike in the past, when you could always say in a much simpler and less crowded political landscape that there was a guaranteed level of support for the Labour Party below which it would not slip because many of those voters didn't really have other places to go, that's very much not the case now. And without sounding too apocalyptic about it, and I'll finish on this, Hugh, you know, I think that if Ivana isn't a success as leader of the Labour Party, they're not, might not be any further leaders of the Labour Party, at least in the way that we have known the party.
I saw you smiling at some of that, Ivana, but not at others. I mean, Pat in some ways lays out quite a bleak landscape there. Listening to him, one of the things that occurs to me is that some of the challenges and the difficulties he describes facing the party are peculiar to Ireland, and some are the same challenges that have been faced by social democratic parties across the Western world in recent years, whether it be Labour's Red Wall or the Democrats in the Rust Belt, or indeed the collapse of the French Socialist Party. We've seen it in a number of places. The Irish Labour Party was always rather unusual among centre-left parties across all those countries because it was never a standalone majority party of government. It never commanded that kind of support. But that kind of coalition, which he describes between middle class progressives and working class trade unionists, has been breaking down across the world. And I suppose it causes me to ask you two questions. One is, do you have any prospect of getting that working class base part of your coalition back? And secondly, Do you have any prospect of making ground against the other parties of the centre left in Ireland, the Greens and the Social Democrats in particular, to actually claw back to where you might have been 20 years ago or more?
Well, thanks, Hugh, and thanks, Pat, for setting it out, as Hugh says, in a rather bleak fashion. You've certainly given me a very clear job description there, and certainly it's challenging. But, you know, what's exciting about it, too, for me, taking on this unexpected new role is what's exciting is the great team we have in Labour. And I think what perhaps that the analysis you and Hugh have provided misses is that we are a very long established party. We're the oldest political party in the state, and we are the political wing of the organised labour and trade union movement. And indeed, we have an incredibly strong base that, again, is often missed or is not evident, perhaps, to those looking at from outside. I mean, even in recent weeks, travelling around and meeting over Zoom, I've been struck with how strong our membership base is around the country in different constituencies, how strong our networks are at local government level, where we've over 50 councillors, over 20 area reps. So that's a base that that perhaps you know, gives us a huge strength from which we build and grow. And that's something that, you know, has other centre-left parties have lacked. You're certainly right, Hugh, in pointing out that this is not that the issue of the future of the centre-left, the social democratic or socialist movement across Europe is a bigger issue than just for here in Ireland. And this question of the, you know, how we win a working class vote or win back working class vote is often asked. I think, if I may say, it paints a somewhat false binary, that idea that this, you know, that we've lost one aspect of our vote. The reality in Labour is, and I've been in the party long enough to know, is that we've always been accused of losing working class. As long ago as I can remember, when I first joined the party in the 80s, Labour was accused of having, lost out working class base, of having this divide between the urban intellectuals and so on. I must say I don't really buy that, because what motivates me to vote for Labour and to support Labour and to be in Labour is the same as what motivates any of us in Labour, and that is a desire to see a more equal Ireland and a desire to see a country in which we have social democratic policies to the fore, in which we see really strong state investment in education and healthcare and housing, in people's needs. And it's that concept of equality and solidarity and fairness, those core Labour values that I suppose motivate me to stay engaged in Labour, and motivate anyone, whatever their background or whatever their whether they live in urban or rural areas. And I do think also Ireland has changed as well. You know, we saw that in Repeal in 2018, where the so-called urban rural divide really wasn't there. People voted according to their beliefs and views. And in the same way, I think Labour will build on the base across different communities and across different constituencies, as we've always done. We've always had to fight for every vote. So I suppose, Pat, I was struck by one thing you said about, you know, Labour have lost a guaranteed level of support. We've never had a guarantee. No party has a guaranteed level of support. You know, that's democracy. And, you know, we've no right to exist, and nor does any political party. And we're very conscious of that. And we in Labour, as Hugh says, we've never been in a position where we could be in a majority partner, let alone standalone in government. And we're unlike other European left parties in that regard. But it does mean that we've always had to fight for every vote, and that we've always been very conscious of that.
The difficulty, though, Ivana, and it's hard to cut across you, is that whereas previously in that period of the modernisation of Ireland, when Labour, you know, periodically shot up and in support and then fell back after being in government. But, you know, talking over the last 30 or 40 years, while for much of that time, Labour was really the only one offering that social democratic, pluralist, equality driven vision of politics, basically everybody's offering that now.
Well, I wish that were the case. I don't think every party is. I think there are still clear policy differences in parties. But again, I suppose my memory is long enough, and my years of activism remind me that, in fact, it was always a crowded space. You know, when I joined again in the late 80s, you know, the Workers' Party were very actively recruiting and indeed growing their voice. What was then the Workers' Party, I should say, what became Democratic Left. They and Labour were seen as competing in the same field. And indeed, Fianna Fáil, and I think one of you pointed this out, Sinn Féin has effectively taken a lot of what would have been Fianna Fáil's base at that time. So, you know, Labour has always had to compete in a crowded field for votes, and I'd be very conscious of that. There has been perhaps a move to the centre for some parties that would have been on the right, and we see that on many issues, but it doesn't mean that we haven't always had to fight in a competed space. And that's, again, democracy, and that's the nature of it. And, you know, what gives me, I suppose, grounds for optimism, and I am an optimist, I think I'd have to be in this job, what gives me grounds for optimism is the fact that we do have other individuals and parties with whom we share common policies and with whom we can work. And I've had a long track record of working on that cross-party basis to try and deliver change. I suppose also what marks Labour out is that we're a party in the centre-left that is serious about seeking to deliver change. We're not apologetic about that. So unlike others, we don't just shout from the sidelines. We don't seek to make, I suppose, just symbolic gestures. What we want to do is actually see our policies delivered through government. And that's a really key aspect of our constructive approach to politics that will remain in place and that remains core to our vision.
I think the point is well made, Pat, that the country has changed enormously. I was listening to Kevin Cunningham, the opinion pollster and political scientist, talking about the census. And, you know, the census of 30 years ago showed a population where almost half the population had not even finished secondary school and only just over 10% had third level education. That has changed enormously on both those metrics in the last 30 years. So in a way, perhaps that base as previously constituted wasn't there in the first place. But the strategic thing I wonder about is that Labour went up and Labour went down over the course of elections over various decades. And it was usually the fly-by-night urban middle-class constituencies that gave it a boost or gave it a kick. But those independent fiefdoms, as they almost were in those provincial towns which you talked about, kind of left the party with some kind of a solid parliamentary presence from election to election. And with that gone, that does make more of an existential threat to the existence of the party as a parliamentary force, doesn't it?
I think there was a hope in parts of the party that the election of Alan Kelly, who's very much from that rural Labour tradition, would reinvigorate the party to the extent that it could regain many of those seats, which, as you say, had been the, you know, albeit that many of them ended up as kind of individual fiefdoms. They were individual fiefdoms that, you know, that were loyal to the Labour leadership by and large. And you're right that the middle class vote has tended, in particularly in urban constituencies in Dublin, has tended to be more fickle. But you know, looking at the electoral map now and the challenges that face, because of course politics doesn't stand still. You know, when a new TD gets elected for a place, he tries to bet in and win the second election. They say that's always the one. If you can win the second election, then the chances are you'll be there for the long term. So you see, you know, Sinn Féin TDs who've been elected in the last election and the one before that now really trying to bed into local politics, the solidity of that local base. And that is a real challenge for Labour. As I say, we'd hoped in parts of the party that Alan Kelly could give them that edge in those sort of constituencies. The polling would suggest that he hadn't really achieved the sort of success in that he might have hoped for. How that might have turned out in an election, we won't know now, but it is certainly, and I know Ivan is now going to tell us that actually she's from Cork and from Waterford and place like that. But, I think that is one of the real challenges facing her, not just to invigorate the local organisation in those sort of places, but to find candidates and the importance of finding the right candidates in Irish elections simply can't be overstated. And maybe we will get a sense of how that is going in the local elections, which are due in 2024. So Vanna's got a bit of a run in for that, but she also needs to be getting her skates on.
Where are the target constituencies for the next general election, Ivana, at the moment, that you think you have a real shot at increasing the number of TDs the party has?
Well, we've quite a number of targets, but it won't surprise you that I'm not going to start naming names. But certainly, as Pat says, you know, the local elections are likely to be the next electoral contest we face. And our work on recruitment has, of course, already started. And indeed, Alan and the team in the party have already been working on this. And we're very optimistic that we will build on what was a good local elections for us in 2019, and that we will ensure that we have a stronger, even stronger network of local representatives of councillors around the country after the next elections in 2024. Looking, I suppose, at the last local elections, I mean, Pat talks about the need to bed down votes and so on. And certainly Sinn Féin had a very poor local elections in 2019. And, it's no secret they were very surprised by their own vote in the February 2020 general election. And of course, hadn't run enough candidates to capitalise on that. So I think all of us are very conscious that, yes, the job of recruiting candidates is really important, but also so is the strategy around which candidates you run and when. But I think everyone in every party would, and any voters would also be very conscious that you can't take anything for granted, that running low or high in the polls doesn't mean that in a particular opinion poll does not mean that that will be the outcome of an election. And I'm a veteran of enough referendum campaigns and election campaigns to know that things can swing in the last week of an election campaign. Events, dear boy, events can transpire, or indeed comments or clever messaging or communications can really sway voters. And so, I think it's very difficult to make any predictions. We are a couple of years out from the next election cycle. That's the likelihood in any case. And so we do have time to build and grow. So yes, our priority and the big challenge is recruiting and building bases for local election candidates, and beyond that for general election candidates, in particular for more women. I mean, I've always championed the need for more women to become engaged in politics and to be elected. And so that'll be a big task.
Is it worth considering again the party's position on its most recent record in government? I noticed that an Irish Times editorial on your appointment as leader said at one point that Labour should stop apologising for its role in the 2011 to 2016 coalition with Fine Gael. But then I noticed a letter writer later in the week suggested that Labour Party hadn't apologised at all, and that it was about time that it did so. The columnist Aidan Regan suggested that Labour's position on this continues to be a kind of a millstone around its neck, arguing that it had to do what it had to do. Lots of people believe, including quite a lot of people on the left, believe that that's not actually the case. Is it worth just going back and getting this monkey off your back?
Well, I saw the Irish Times editorial and I was very interested in it. And indeed, I've seen a lot of the commentary around our time in government from 2011 to 16. And I've been asked about it in lots of interviews. Alan himself referred to it as one of the reasons for his own resignation. And clearly, as I've said, Labour ministers in that government had to take actions that no Labour minister would ever wish to take in normal times. But patently, it wasn't a normal time. The country had been bankrupted by the outgoing Fianna Fáil and Green Party government. And indeed, as a result of the fateful bank guarantee that was supported by Fine Gael and the Green Party, but was opposed by Labour in September 2008. And what I suppose, reflecting on the questions and reflecting on the commentary, what strikes me as really interesting is that Fianna Fáil and Green Party representatives, who are, some of whom are now in government, are never asked in interviews about their role in a government that bankrupted the country. And Fine Gael and Sinn Féin representatives are never asked about their role in voting for the bank guarantee that brought about such catastrophic financial consequences and which Labour opposed. We voted against it. And I was in the Shannon. I recall voting against it. And I recall being surprised that, in particular, that Sinn Féin were supporting it. So, I do think we do have to move on. We've now been out of that government for longer than we were in it. And those in their 20s now in Ireland who are facing such huge challenges on, particularly on housing, but also on jobs, on childcare, on healthcare, they weren't old enough to vote in 2011. So we do have to move on, and we do have to confront the real challenges that are facing us as we come through COVID and as we witness the horrific war in Ukraine and the consequences of that for all of us on cost of living, on an energy crisis, and indeed on the environment too. So, massive challenges ahead, but also massive lessons from COVID about what the state can and should do, and a real time for the centre-left voice and vision for Ireland to grow in strength. So I think there's an appetite there for that, Hugh, and I think that we do need to move on, and that's my response. I've reflected on it, as I say, and I do think that other party representatives have moved on, and indeed it's in a perhaps a surprising way from decisions that they took that led us into financial catastrophe.
I suppose this is a kind of a balance that's always been there in the history of the Labour Party, almost throughout the history of the state, isn't it? That on the one hand, I mean, you said earlier that Labour is a party of the left that is not content just to heckle from the sidelines. It wants to get in and to make a real difference from within government. But the counterbalance to that, and we've seen lots of tensions in it over the years in the Labour Party, is that the Labour Party, the accusation is the party that will make compromises for power and sell out its principles. Now, I'm not saying that that's right, but that tension goes right back to, you know, back to the 80s when you were there, when Militant were in Labour, all those arguments about going into coalition or getting out of coalition. And it still seems to be there, and maybe that's why Labour gets held to this higher standard that you describe, other than in a different way than other parties.
There is a tension there. I think you're quite right. And it's not just a tension for Labour. It's a tension for any small party going into power. And again, looking at the Green Party's, their trajectory, I think we see the same pattern. Again, it's a consequence of democratic structures. And the fact that a smaller party that goes into government necessarily faces compromising on more of its policies than the larger party in government. And certainly in the 2011-16 government, Labour ministers were outnumbered 2-1 by Fine Gael ministers. So, you know, that is also an important point. But I do think that we need to stand up against the idea that parties always have to be punished for going into government, because that is the way we deliver policies and that is the way to achieve change. So I don't think we should be apologetic about having taken decisions to go into government in the past, nor should we be apologetic about seeking to do so in the future. But for me, I don't believe we should go into government unless we have the critical mass and the numbers necessary to deliver on key and core policies. And that, I think, is crucial. And I think all small parties have learnt that over many years.
What do you think of this, Pat? Is this a tired debate at this point, or is it still hanging over Labour?
I think it's time in government, and the party admitted this himself. Alan Kelly admitted, as Ivana says, that the party's time in government in 2011 to 2016 is still something of a millstone hanging around her neck. Whether that will simply pass with the passage of time, or whether it will requires an intervention by Ivana on one side of that argument or other, either to defend the decisions that Labour took in that government and its part in that government and say, you know, well, look, we didn't get everything right, but we left the country in a better position than it was when we entered government, and we make no apologies for that and we would do the same again. Or whether she chooses to say that, no, we made an absolute hens of it, we should never have done that, we should have left government rather than make those decisions that Fine Gael forced us into. I mean, that's up to her what choice, whether she wishes to take either of those options or whether, as I suspect she may do, simply to hope that the passage of time detoxifies Labour amongst some of those voters that still nurture resentment against the party stemming from that time in government. One might add, I think, that the resentment that was exercised or that was excited in the minds of some voters at that time was probably contributed to by Labour in the election campaign, the period before it entered government, when it suggested that it could protect voters from the ravages of what a Fine Gael single party government would have done. On the broader question of smaller parties going in government, it is certainly usually it's usually the experience of small parties when they go into government that they experience electoral difficulty afterwards, and there's numerous examples of that. But it's not always the case, actually. The PDs famously flourished after a period in government, a government that was re-elected in 2002 after the PDs time in government, which was occasionally torrid between 97 and 2002. The PDs doubled the number of seats that they won in the 2002 election. So a government that was seen by voters as performing well, both parties were rewarded by the voters subsequently. So it's not an iron law of Irish politics that small parties have to get monstered in the subsequent election. But what it requires is for the voters to believe that that small party has done a good job in its period in government. And to some extent, that depends on, you know, things like economic circumstances with which they're faced. But it also depends on how the small party manages itself in government. And, you know, we have a live experiment going on in that regard at the moment with the Green Party, whose vote, according to opinion polls, is holding up. And I think that's because the Green Party is largely getting results, or is on a track to get results on those issues that the people that vote for it or may vote for it care about. Now, we'll see what happens. And we're only, you know, as Vanna correctly points out, we're a long time from the next election. But the evidence thus far at this point in government is that the smallest part of that government is not on course for an electoral monstering when the time comes. So, I don't think small parties should be afraid of government. Many of them are. I don't think they should be, because if they make a success of it, they stand a chance of being rewarded by voters.
There's another way of looking at that, Ivana, which is that actually, if you look at some of the policies put forward by Sinn Féin and the way in which it defines itself to the electorate, if you look at the combined vote of Labour and the Social Democrats and the Greens, and if you look at a number of other, quite a significant number of other TDs who define themselves as being on the left, is that Ireland is much further to the left than it's ever been previously, and that just the challenge for Labour is to define its place within that enlarged space.
Sorry, there's a lot there in what you and Pat have said, Hugh, and I'm just interested in Pat's example of the PDs. Of course, that could be the exception that proves the rule, but I do agree with you, Pat. I don't think smaller parties or any parties should be afraid to go into government. I think that would be disastrous for a democracy, you know, and it's not just about going into the government. It's not about that at all. It's about seeking to deliver the policies you care about. I mean, I would like Labour to be able to deliver on childcare in government, to deliver on a redistributive policy on wealth and on taxation that, you know, we've always stood for. And I'd like us to be able to deliver, along with, you know, environmentalists, on a sort of red-green politics that for me is the future of politics, that environmentalist and socialist combination. So that brings me to your question, Hugh, sorry, about, you know, the common ground with other parties on the left or centre-left or indeed in the Green movement. And as I said, I have a long record of working with other parties and like-minded individuals, and will continue to do so. And we've always done that in a collaborative fashion to deliver on policies that are common to us. But I wouldn't envisage any more formal alliance, because my focus is on building and growing our own party as a standalone party, and bringing our own message clearly on centre-left, progressive and constructive values to the next election, be it the locals in 2024 or beyond that, and seeking as strong a vote and as strong a support for our values as I can. So that's really the challenge. That's the big challenge, if you like, that Pat has laid out as a more detailed job description. But I think that's the focus. It's not on other parties. And in fact, in the by-election campaign last summer, we took a very assertive view that we weren't going to engage in the politics of pulling down or tearing down others or trying to score political points against others. Rather, we were going to approach it with a positive strategy of putting forward our own policies and making our own arguments for change, and doing so in a constructive way, to the point where we didn't engage with you know, sort of toxic discourse or debate on Twitter. We just sought to put forward a positive view, and you know, there is a real appetite for that more positive, constructive style of politics that is less shouty, less adversarial, less combative. And we really saw that messaging gaining ground in the by-elections so effectively. And people saying they liked that they really liked that different sort of approach to doing politics. And I think that's really crucial to our way of doing things as we move forward.
And then a number of political analysts, not least among them a certain Mr. Pat Leahy, have looking forward to the next election. Obviously, Sinn Féin are in pole position, and the prospect of Sinn Féin becoming the majority party in the next government is a very real one. And at that juncture, the question really, at the moment, looks as if it'll be a question of, do they go into coalition with a number of smaller left-wing parties, or do they go into coalition with Fianna Fáil? Which begs the question, what do you make of Sinn Féin and its current position on the political spectrum, and how comfortable would you be to be in government with them?
First of all, I think it's far too soon, as I say before, far too long out from any election cycle to be making predictions about whether polls will hold up, because we saw in the by-election again in just a few weeks how polls can really change and shift, and how messaging and events can affect voters' decisions and outcomes. So I wouldn't make any predictions about the next election at this point. And again, my view of Sinn Féin, as of any other party, is we'll work with them on where we have issues of common interest, or where there are common policy goals, but we are not envisaging any sort of alliance or any sort of anything more formal, because we want to grow Labour. We've enough of a job ahead to grow Labour from its base and to grow our support for our values and our voice. And that's my focus.
Can I just interrogate that a little bit? Because I think Ivana's going to have to answer this question sooner or later. She may not want to answer it until closer to the general election or not. But if Sinn Féin, and I agree with Hugh's analysis that there's maybe two routes to government for Sinn Féin. There's the head of a left-wing coalition, if the numbers are there, or there's coalition with Fianna Fáil. So let's take, for a start, let's take that first option. Let's assume that the numbers are there for a left-wing coalition that would need Labour and would be led by Sinn Féin. Now, we know that at this stage that Sinn Féin is not just a left-wing party; it's a nationalist party by some. By some measures, a very nationalist party. And one of the central planks, I think one of the two central planks of a government led by Sinn Féin after the next election will be the push for a united Ireland. Would Labour be prepared to sign up for that, to sign up to serve in a government that had as one of its chief priorities the achievement as soon as possible of a united Ireland?
On the United Ireland, I've very clearly set out my own position and that of the party. I would like to see a united Ireland, and I think most people in this jurisdiction would, and Labour stands for that. But we're also very conscious of the need to ensure that we don't undermine the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement and the core principle of consent on which that agreement was founded. So I believe we would need to lay the groundwork. We, on the island, would North and South, would need to lay the groundwork very carefully before envisaging the holding of any referendum on unification. And in particular, I think we would need to see deliberative democracy processes North and South, like the Citizens' Assembly, using that sort of model to ensure that we have the space to enable citizens to debate how to go about such a referendum in a way that wouldn't undermine principles of the consent. And I suppose if one unpicks that, in order to establish citizens' assemblies, excuse me, one needs to have built the support for that in both Stormont and in Dublin and in the Oireachtas here. So, you know, there'd be a lot of careful groundwork that would need to be done. First, we saw in Brexit how that wasn't done with such dreadful consequence, you know, with such, I suppose, well, from our view in Ireland, such awful consequences. But also we saw in repeal and in marriage equality how creating spaces and building up the groundwork can really help in ensuring that referendum processes don't undermine, I suppose, public solidarity and communities and how carefully we can build alliances through that process. So that would be my view on unification.
But that's kind of avoiding the question, though, with all due respect, because what you're talking about is the traditional soft nationalist position of all Irish governments, is that of course we want to see unity in the long term, but it's important to build relationships with the North, and only when we are ready should a referendum be contemplated and so forth. What Sinn Féin is talking about is something quite different. It is transforming the foreign policy of an Irish government and transforming the policy priorities of an Irish government to the achievement of unity in the short term, and as near as possible. Mary Lou talked, she would certainly want to be pushing the British government for a referendum within the 5 years of that government's term of office. And the question, I suppose, is would you be prepared to go along with that policy, which would, I think, be different to the Northern Anglo-Irish policy of all previous Irish governments?
The question you're asking me, I think, is a very hypothetical one, Pat, if you don't mind me saying. And looking some years into the future.
It's not at all.
So, as I've said, you know, I'm not prepared to make that sort of speculation. I would say that I don't think a party on the left should be opposed to property tax, a tax on wealth, nor do I think that a party that is serious about environmentalism should oppose carbon taxes. So I think there are clear policy differences between Labour and Sinn Féin, as indeed there are between Labour and Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, on different issues. And it's those sort of policy differences, I think, that would militate against, or would, you know, I suppose, tip the balance against any sort of arrangement or coalition or alliance. But I think it's too soon out to be making any sort of giving any sort of answers to those hypothetical questions, because my focus is on building Labour, building our policies, building our voice on the issue of North, on the status of the island and the issue of Northern Ireland, as much as on any other policy around around childcare and healthcare, education or and housing. So it's the challenge for us is to build our own policy and build our own voice and our own support, as we did in the by-election, and that's really my focus. It's not on what other parties are doing or on whether we would agree with other parties' positions on things. You know, we, our policies are very clear, and there are clear policy differences between us and other parties. And sorry about the Shannon bell, which I know is probably going off on your in the background there.
That must stir something within you.
It does. It genuinely does. I jump. You probably saw me twitching with the, I heard the Shannon bell, and the doll bell still does with years of being ingrained.
And the last question, because economic issues are tend to what drive political results in the end of the day. We're in a very unusual, very uncertain economic moment. We've got kind of inflation that we haven't seen for several decades. The question of what to do about that is very important. I mean, you talked earlier on about the importance of Labour's base and Labour's relationships with the trade unions. SIPTU and other unions are calling for renegotiation of existing pay agreements. Others say that that's going to just create the spiral of inflation, which we saw previously and which put this country into a disastrous position. What do you think should happen?
Well, what put the country into the disastrous position before was the bank bailout and the economic crash worldwide, I suppose, rather than inflation itself. Most recently, I know.
Well, I'm actually talking about one of the country's several disastrous positions. I was talking about the one a generation earlier.
Yeah, sorry. As I was saying that to you, I was thinking, yes, you mean the 1980s. Okay. And there's no denying the really frightening impact that inflation is having on people's day-to-day expenses, on their incomes, and I'm hearing it every day from my own constituents across Dublin Bay South, in particular rental costs and mortgage rental costs, and fear of being evicted, and the fact that those who were getting by are now finding their income is simply not, they simply aren't earning enough to be able to pay rent and other basic bills around fuel and energy. So that is why I said in my speech at the launch of the leadership last Thursday that Ireland does need a pay rise, that the most effective way to tackle increases in cost of living is not just the state interventions that are necessary to, for example, you know, give people more in fuel allowance and in targeted measures, but also to ensure that that unions have the strength to engage in collective bargaining and negotiation to ensure people get a pay rise. So we need to see improvements in pay and conditions to meet the rising cost of living. And I know the ESRI has warned against the what they're calling that inflationary spiral, but they did also say that a balance had to be struck. And I think when we're seeing employers around the country in every sector saying they cannot recruit staff, there is a clear need to offer people more pay, because we need to, you know, that's one of the reasons why people are not taking up jobs, why we're seeing so many vacancies. And it is also a reason why people are finding the cost of living increases just so challenging and difficult, is because pay rises haven't increased commensurate with increases in the cost of living. So I think that's a crucial point. But it's, for me, it's tied to the need to ensure greater rights for collective bargaining and for trade unions. And I should say, I very much welcome the government's announcement today about sick pay. That's something Labour have been pushing for some time. So it's not just about pay rates themselves, it's also about conditions, things like sick pay, like pension entitlements, like the gender pay gap. I mean, these are all part of a package of measures to improve pay and conditions for people who are struggling, who are working, but who are still finding it very hard to get by, particularly with rental costs and with childcare costs. And we've again got a big policy to ensure that childcare costs will be greatly reduced, and that the state will guarantee a free childcare place for every child. We see that as a crucial part of building economic prosperity and building the development moment of our society. I've called for it as a Dun O'Malley moment. You know, like we talked earlier about the move to a more educated population, the guarantee of a free secondary place for every child 50 years ago, transformative on the Irish economy and on Irish society. And in the same way, a free childcare place, I believe, would do the same for us. And we should be doing that. I mean, we're already investing more than we ever have in the sector, but it's piecemeal and it's, you know, it's still relying on private providers. We do need to move to a different model.
I think just on that, on the point, sorry, yeah, I think economic issues will come to dominate over the next 6 months, because the inflation spike is obviously here to stay, and we're heading into all those sort of cost of living pressures that you've described. I was, as part of my extensive preparation for this morning's encounter, I was rereading pieces of Ivana's book, Kicking and Screaming,
How
Ireland Was Dragged
it,
into the 20th century or 21st century or whatever it was. And what struck me about it is that practically all the chapters dealt with social issues and issues of personal and sexual freedom. There was, you know, chapters on abortion and divorce and gay rights and so forth. And I suppose it's fair to say that they are the issues with which Ivana personally was probably most closely associated in the public mind. But I think that, you know, more pocketbook type issues will come to dominate politics over the next, partly because those goals of liberal Ireland that the Labour Party was in the forefront in arguing for have largely been achieved, but also because of the extent to which global inequality has become a part of politics in recent years. I think Ivana may be onto something in the childcare issue. I know Labour tried to make it a big plank of their general election campaign last time, and it didn't really fly, but I think it will fly for somebody at some stage in the future, whether that's Ivana's Labour Party or not, I don't know. But I think that the extent of the need and the desire among voters for the state to offer solutions to issues like this, which is greater now probably than at any time in the past, will mean that that is a political opportunity for somebody.
Yeah, we should come back to those economic issues, which, as you say, are vital. Maybe another time, if you'll come back to us again, Ivana.
If I could just say one line, Hugh, on that, which is, and first of all, thank you, Pat, for rereading my book, which I think is out of print now. But secondly, you know, while I did focus on legal changes that were needed there, I would contest the idea that these are all social. For me, as a student union activist taking calls from women in crisis pregnancy, it was an economic as well as a social issue. Women from working class backgrounds, from disadvantaged backgrounds, who were unable to afford to travel to England, were by far more impacted than any other women by the ban on abortion and the outrageous laws we had under the Eighth Amendment. And similarly, issues that have been kind of traditionally described as social always have an economic aspect. Social and economic equality for me are absolutely intertwined and interlinked, and you cannot separate the two, because there's always a class or financial or economic dimension. And I think that's crucial to our Labour message. And it's a point I made last week and I really want to keep emphasising, because I think, again, too often, you know, Labour are described as only focusing on one or other. And in fact, these issues, social and economic, are both so strongly intertwined, and nowhere more evidently so than in the area of childcare, which is, you know, from what I know from my own constituents, from what I know from around the country, it is a huge issue, as you say, affordability and lack of places and just an absence of the state intervening to ensure that every child gets this guarantee of an equal start.
And on that welcome note of correction to Pat, which is always something we like to hear in this podcast, we will leave it there. Ivana, listen, thanks very much indeed for joining us today. Thanks also to Pat. Thanks to our producer, Jennifer Ryan, our engineer, JJ Vernon. You can drop us an email at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. We're going to be back very soon. But until then, thanks very much indeed for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taking to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.